Okay, Dr. Almond, are you beginning? Is it Mrs. Drabtani? Perfect. Okay, hi, everybody. So glad you're all here. It's really nice to see everybody. I actually think that just by being here tonight, we accomplished our goal. Our goal tonight is to ensure that everyone knows that halacha and medicine work together. As observant Jews, we are always looking for the best way to connect to our tradition and halacha, while at the same time take care of ourselves to the highest and most updated medical standards. Tonight's purpose was to illustrate that through knowledge and sharing of all of our information, both Torah and medicine can actually have our greatest commitment. So we're going to start with birth control. We will get to menopause later. Hopefully, I can't say it's going to be exactly equal, but everyone can enjoy both parts, hopefully. The topic of birth control is a highly discussed, highly debated, and a very complex topic in Jewish law. It's complex for many reasons, but one issue that arises when discussing birth control is the Deoraita, the biblical mitzvah, in Bereishit, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Kaf Ched, chapter 1, verse 28, where it says, "Peru uruvu umulua ta'aretz," that we should be fruitful and multiply and fill up the land. This is a very important charge given to us in our Torah, to have children and populate the world. It involves the wife, the husband, and a Kodesh Baruch Hu, and is therefore taken very seriously in Jewish law. However, how one should incorporate it and practice it in their own lives is beyond the scope of tonight's discussion. There are numerous and extensive works, halachic works, written about it. Family planning is a halachic question. The question of using birth control should be handled like all other halachic questions. But that decision to use birth control is not tonight's topic. That whole discussion we call step one of using birth control. Tonight, we're going to be learning about step two. Step two is the what and the how of birth control, both medically and halachically. So with no further ado, because this is who I came to hear tonight, Dr. Elman, if you could please tell us from the medical perspective what we need to know about the various forms of birth control.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And if anyone has a question, please feel free to just stop me or just shout out. Birth control is something that I do every day at work. And a lot of the different methods for birth control really depend on the individual person and what they need in the short term and the long term. I may have somebody who is just delivered a baby and wants to have another baby relatively soon but have a little bit of space. Or I may have a woman who's done with babies. I may have a woman who's being treated for breast cancer and needs to not get pregnant. So there are a lot of different factors that go into what we pick for each woman if it's appropriate to use birth control at that time. So I'm going to give a quick, somewhat quick, I tend to talk on and on as all my patients know who wait for me in the office, about the different methods that are available. And I'll talk a little bit about who they may be appropriate for and in what setting we might use them. And in general, when we look at birth control, a good way to think about it is to divide them up into hormonal methods of birth control and non-hormonal methods of birth control. Hormonal methods include things like the birth control pill. And anybody who's seen our sample cabinets, disaster of shelves with things falling all over the place, know that there's many different types of birth control pills out there. There are some that contain estrogen and progesterone in them, and I'll talk about those. There are some that only contain progesterone in them, and I'll tell you why we might use those. We also have, in the past probably 10 years, two new birth control methods that are just like the birth control pill, but you don't swallow them. One is something called the NuvaRing. So it's a rubber ring that goes in the vagina. It acts just like a birth control pill without actually having to swallow a pill. So it has the same hormones in it that a birth control pill would have. There's also something that we actually have moved away from prescribing, but you may hear about it, a patch. There is a birth control patch that has the same hormones in it as the birth control pill. And there may be situations where those methods within the hormonal birth control family are preferred over taking a pill. The other thing, which I kind of alluded to, is what the goal of the patient is. Do they have any medical issues? Do they have any health problems that would make estrogen not a good thing for them to take? Do they not do well with hormones? All of these things are things we kind of have to put together to come up with a plan for each person. First of all, to talk about the birth control pill, this and this are two examples of a relatively typical pill. Anybody my age or older would recognize this potentially. There are 3 weeks of orange pills, or they could be pink or blue or whatever color they decide to color them, and then 1 week of white pills, which are placebo pills and contain no hormone or medicine in them whatsoever. So a woman would start here and go 1 week, 2 week, 3 weeks, and then as she's taking her 4th week, she would get her period somewhere in these white pills if things go the way we want them to. This is the newer pill that all my patients younger than me are used to seeing. There are 1, 2, 3.5 weeks of white, or 3.5 weeks of white pills and 4 brown placebo pills. So the reason why the birth control pill companies who make these pills did this has nothing to do with medicine and everything to do with money and maintaining patents. But what they found is when they put a few extra pills in each pack, not only did they make a lot of money and keep their patents going, but women actually had much lighter periods or didn't have periods at all on this pill. And then the one thing I couldn't drum up, because we don't get samples of them, are the pills that are marketed to give you a period once a season, seasonal, seasonique. And what the pack would look like would be literally 3 of these stacked 1, 2, 3 in a big pack. One of the nurses called it the Big Mac of birth control pills, and it actually looked like that too because it was round. That is exactly the same thing as this. It's all marketing, the exact same hormones in all of the active pills, but only 1 week of placebo pills for every 3 months, so that a woman would potentially not have a period except for every 3 months. So after that introduction, let me just talk really quickly about how this works. So the way this works is it prevents a woman from ovulating. So I don't know if anybody remembers those dreadful high school biology curves with the hormones going up and down. Basically, what this does is it gets rid of the ups and the downs. So it flattens out a woman's hormones, and therefore, without the ups and the downs, there's no what we call LH surge or hormonal surge that makes you ovulate your egg. So if you don't ovulate an egg, you can't get pregnant. And if you don't ovulate an egg, typically your period would be very light and sometimes even non-existent. And all of these types of regular birth control pills that have estrogen and progesterone in them all work the same way. So even if you did the seasonal and only had a period once every 3 months, you would still never be ovulating throughout the course of the month to month to month. Next question is, who could use these? Well, pretty much anybody in general could be a candidate for the birth control pill, with a few exceptions. Anybody who has a family history or personal history of a blood clot in a leg or a lung, or anybody who carries an inherited predisposition to blood clots would absolutely not be a candidate for a birth control pill. Women who get, oh, sorry, go ahead.
What if you take a blood thinner?
So even with a blood thinner, people who have a predisposition to a clot can still get a clot. So once a woman's had a clot, even if it was a small clot that nobody ever really realized, that blood vessel is damaged. So once the clot's there, there is almost like a scar that's left behind. So even though the blood thinner is thinning out that blood, it's still more likely to get a clot in that space. So that's the reason why, even because that's a very natural question, why not just give people a baby aspirin or some heparin and still put them on the pill? But that's why we don't do that. People who get migraines with something called an aura. So a lot of people tell me they have migraines when they come in. It's very actually picky to distinguish between migraines and headaches. But people with true migraines who get an aura, flashing lights, light sensitivity, other symptoms like that with their migraines are also at risk for getting a blood clot on the birth control pill, because what's causing that aura is their blood vessels are spasming a little bit. People with a history of certain types of cancers, we wouldn't want them to take birth control pills, not just the hormonal cancers I think everybody's mind goes to, like breast cancer, but any cancer can increase your risk for a blood clot. So we try to not give those types of patients birth control pills if we can. And then anybody with bad heart disease or high blood pressure that's not controlled would not be a good candidate for these pills, all boiling down to the same thing, the blood clots. Go ahead.
The pack of pills, the new one that has only four, how is that different from the original one?
So the original one has 3 weeks of active, 1 week of placebo. So the way it works is you take your active pills and then essentially you stop. And over the course of the time, you're not only starting to shed a lining, but you're also starting to prepare for the next cycle. So what really is the end is also the beginning of the next cycle. So you're allowing lining to, as the lining starts to shed, you're also revving up hormones for the next month. So you're allowing that process to happen, which is why people tend to get heavier, they're not heavy, but heavier periods. On this one, you only have 4 days without a hormone pill. So what happens here is just as you're starting to shed, you're coming back in with new hormones.
So basically, it's almost like skipping a pack, but like just giving you a tiny
Exactly. And to make it even crazier, these companies all want, you know, their patents. So some of them will put 4 pills and 3 placebos, or 2 pills that are full strength and 2 pills that are half strength, and then a couple placebos.
And why would somebody choose that over just doing pack to pack?
Very good question. So so pack to pack can be very complicated for multiple reasons. Probably the biggest reason is actually convenience. So insurance companies do not want to let you pick up your pills one day early sometimes. So a lot of my patients who run pills pack to pack to pack to pack without taking the placebos have trouble running out.
Knowing that they have to get it that day.
Exactly. So and since most women, and since most women may not get a period on this anyway, there's no incentive to have to run that pack back to back.
So on this, you definitely will not get a period?
Not definitely. It's really person to person. But I would say, and I'm giving you, you know, the Carol Ellman statistic, probably half my patients on these pills stop getting periods. So this one is Minastrin. And it's got a sister pill that's lower dose called a fancy marketing name, Low Estrin. This used to be called Low Estrin. So somehow they came up with that.
Lomedia also the same thing?
Say it again.
Lomedia.
So Lomedia is a generic similar to this. But the problem with some of the generics, a lot of the generics actually don't do this last week this way. A lot of the generics have the same ingredients, but when you go to pick it up, you get this. So on the generics, you may be more likely to get a period than on the name brand. And unfortunately, I don't know if anybody else has tried to fill prescriptions this year yet, but there's been a lot of changes with insurance. And what a lot of the companies are going to are their preferred pills, which may be free, but then they'll make you pay something like $100 when you try to go pick this up. So they're really pushing you to have to take their preferred pills. And my pet peeve with that is that they give you a list of like 30 preferred pills, but when you actually sit there and go through them, over half of them are pills for breastfeeding, so you can knock those out if you're not breastfeeding. And then when you really go through, I can sometimes, I had a list of 30 and came up with 3 pills that I would actually use in a patient. So it can be very difficult to find a good pill that's covered.
Is there a greater risk of spotting taking the Minestrin versus the regular pills versus the pack to pack?
Very good question. So the answer is no, with an asterisk, and let me tell you what I mean by that. So there's nothing really different about this in terms of how much hormones in it. It's a lot about packaging and marketing. So you're no more likely to spot on this than you would be basically on this when you start it up. When you do packs back to back to back, what we will find is that most people can make it till about 8 to 10 weeks, and then they start to spot.
So on this one, is this, so I'm saying this one.
Yep.
So the first one.
Yep.
So let's say the first couple of months you would spot until you regulate your system.
Yes.
The second one, Is that the same thing?
Same thing.
It works the same way.
It works the same way.
Once you're on it for a few months, then yes, you're not spotting anything.
You're not spotting. And then the other thing this company realized is that here we used to tell everybody, and again, the people my age will remember, start on Sunday, the first Sunday after your period starts, start your pill. Well, why? You know why they did that? It just was convenient. There was no medical reason or data behind that. So these guys tell you, the first day you bleed, start this. And guess what? You're capturing, again, not just the end of the cycle, but the beginning of the next, and you have less chance of spotting as much. So these guys actually do better, but not because they have a better product. They're giving you better instructions on how to do it.
When she's done, which is the next part, I'm going to go through the halakhic ramifications when you're on a pill and the spotting changes and the spotting starts and your days get longer, your days get shorter, and we're going to talk about that in the second half after.
Okay. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then, one quick thing I want to mention also about these is that of all the things I'm going to talk about today, this also has a significant place as a treatment for things other than preventing pregnancy. We do use these in women who have a history of ovarian cysts. We use these actually in women with a strong family history or if they're a gene carrier for breast cancer and ovarian cancer. This can lower your risk for those. This can lower your risk for uterine cancer too. We have some people who have very painful periods or really long periods, and this can usually be a good treatment for that. And interestingly, these are actually now FDA approved as treatment for things like acne and hair growth. So keep in mind that sometimes we call it the pill and the birth control pill, but we often use it for non-birth control reasons too. Pros and cons. So you alluded to the big con, which can be spotting, breakthrough bleeding, which can obviously lead to a lot of issues that we'll talk about. Some people love being on the pill. Other people don't love being on the pill. You know, I feel like I've learned when I first started, I'd say, oh, that can't be from the pill. And now I've learned to say, you know what, I don't hear that as much, but yes, this could be pill. Let's see what we can modify. It is possible to give women some bloating, breast tenderness, nausea. It's also likely to solve bloating, breast tenderness, nausea. So keep that in mind. And then probably the biggest thing that's an issue for my younger patients is everybody's worried about gaining weight on the pill. And with the current formulations of the pill that we have on the market, the actual studies that they've done, which I will tell you are not awesome, but they're the ones that are out there say, no, there's no weight gain associated with the birth control pill. There may be some fluid retention in a cyclic fashion, but when they start people on a pill and they bring them back in 6 months and then they bring them back in the year, they do not see weight gain. I will tell you that I've had some people say, I started the pill, nothing else is different, and now I am 5 pounds more than I used to be, and I believe them. But overall, it's not something that I try to very much alleviate the fears, particularly my younger people who may not be so compliant with it if they think they're going to gain weight. Couple of other things just to know, there are some negatives to the birth control pill, and I've alluded to the blood clot, blood clot, blood clot, and that is the big bad thing that these things can do. Hormones, the female hormone estrogen, increases our risk for blood clots. So we as women have a higher risk of a blood clot, even with no extra hormone in our body, than men do. And sometimes then you can add in other things that can increase your risk for blood clot, like more hormone, either maybe when we're pregnant or when we take things like birth control pills. So on these pills, if we just took women not on hormones, the risk of a blood clot is about 4.5 women per 10,000 women, just young women walking around. If we take those women and put them on birth control pills, we almost double that risk. So what does that mean? 7.8 women per 10,000. So it's still a small number, but it's more. And there are other birth control pills, one subset of pills, which can actually increase that risk a little bit higher, that we tend to try not to prescribe anymore, something called Yaz. And Yasmin, a lot of people have heard of that one because everybody loves that one, of course. So a blood clot in a leg can mobilize up and cause a pulmonary embolism, which can be a life-threatening event. Sometimes in women that are getting a little older, a little heavier, who may be smoking, all of those can increase your risk for clots and increase your risk from a clot then leading to a stroke or a heart attack. So we try, for instance, in our field, we are guided to never give birth control pills to women who smoke if they're over 35, women who have a certain weight and they're over 35. We do some different type of counseling about things like that. Couple of other quick things about the birth control pill, and then I'll stop for questions there and then move on to a couple other things. Number one, we talked a little bit already about the options. There's the 21 days of active pills versus the 24 days of active pills, or the Big Mac, 3 months of active pills are all options. And again, they're all the exact same thing, just packaged differently. So keep that in mind. The other options that we have is something that I alluded to earlier called the mini pill. So anybody who's had a baby may have heard of the mini pill. It is what we also call the breastfeeding pill. It is a pill that only has progesterone in it. And by removing the estrogen, the estrogen can lower your milk production to a very significant degree. So by removing the estrogen, we can provide contraception without lowering milk production. And we have plenty of studies that ensure us that progesterone is safe for the babies to get through the breast milk. And it's this, the same hormone they were exposed to in utero, and it has been around for quite some time.
Is that the only purpose of it, the mini pill?
Well, yes, except, so yes, and another asterisk, sorry, I keep saying yes and no. So really it is, and the reason why is that most breastfeeding women are not cycling. So most women do great. Some can spot, and again, we'll talk about that, but most women do very well. Once your cycles come back, they are dreadful on the mini pill. The mini pill has no breaks, so a mini pill package has all 4 weeks of white pills, and you never not take a little bit of progesterone. So where is that period going to come? It's going to come wherever it wants to. It's going to last for however long it wants to. You could have 2 in 1 month. You could have a 2 week period. That's when people call me and say, okay, we're done with this pill.
I do have a question. So what happens, let's say, is there going to be a certain frequency that while you're on the mini pill in order to ensure that you're not going to be getting pregnant or giving your period, that you have to be breastfeeding, or is that totally negated topic? Do you know what I mean? Like, can you
say that again?
So let's say like you're breastfeeding.
Yeah. Yes.
So in the beginning you're breastfeeding a lot, but as you get older you're not breastfeeding as much, but you're still on your mini pill.
Yeah.
But you still want to be nursing. But at what point do you transition to
very good question?
Is minestrone low estrogen or it's not?
This one is low. The old low estrogen again ran out of their patent, made it chewable, and called it minestrone. Yeah, it's the exact same thing. You can chew it now. So your question is a good one. And what we usually do, so when women, and often it's right around 6 to 8 months, women start to breastfeed a little less, babies start to eat regular food, maybe they're sleeping through the night a little bit more. And often women can start to get a period. And so typically what we'll do is tell people, okay, when your first period starts, maybe check in with us. And if you're doing well and everything's going fine and you really want, worried about that breast milk going down, we can keep you on the mini pill with the understanding that at any point, if the bleeding starts to get to be too much, we just switch you over to regular pill.
Unless the period hasn't come yet.
Then you can just keep going with the mini pill.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the mini pill works great. It is just as effective for preventing pregnancy, except it just causes the bad bleeding when the cycles come back. So like a woman who can't take estrogen, let's say she has a family history of a clotting disorder, she could try to take the mini pill all the time, but I've never had anybody make it more than a year on the mini pill without having to just switch off.
Isn't it possible, though, to still be on the mini pill a few weeks or even a month or two after stopping breastfeeding but still not get a period back?
Yes, absolutely. And actually, the mini pill can delay the return of your first period by a little bit. Usually when they do, again, these studies, all the studies in women's health are overall pretty poor. But yes, they say 2 to 4 weeks you can delay a period with the mini pill. So a lot of times what people, if they're doing well, we'll say just stay on it till you get your period, and then we'll just need to have a plan B, because invariably that period comes like, in the 2 in the morning, and you want to make sure you've got your next pill ready to go if you want to go on pills. Anybody have any other questions about the birth control pill? One thing I didn't talk about was the very first thing I wrote down in red. How effective is it? So with perfect use of a birth control pill, it's about 99% effective. with actual use of a birth control pill, it's anywhere between 2%, there's about a 2% to 9% failure rate. And when they separate out, interestingly, married women from unmarried women, they find that the married women are on the 2% side and the unmarried women are on the 9% side. These are all studies done across big populations, so it may not necessarily be extremely relevant. I don't want to jinx anything, but in our practice, birth control pill failures are extremely few and far between. We tend to see more failures with some of the other things that I'll talk about.
It's relatively safe to go back to back on the pill, right?
It is, and I always joke that, all of my friends who are OBGYNs and women, you know, I don't know any OBGYN that's having a failure every month for the most part. It is very safe to go back to back. It is very safe to skip a period. It's very safe to take a pill just as it's prescribed and not get a period. I had a mom call me and say, oh my gosh, my daughter is still not getting her period, and you started her on the pill because she wasn't getting her period. And I said, okay, well, now I know why, and there's nothing bad about that. So when women are on the pills and not getting period, it is considered to be safe. You're not building up more and more and more lining in there or anything. It's all just nice and stable. And there's no delay to return to fertility from women who take the pill and get a period every month compared to women who don't, for women who run it back to back. So there's no reason to think if you want to get pregnant that you have to stop that model.
Like how many months can you go before you say, okay, no, this isn't.
Well, while there is a lot of debate about that, all of the research studies show, and what we clinically see, is that we have some women who never stop. So unless they want to have a baby or they decide they want to do something else. So we don't see a negative to that.
They never get a period.
There are some women who don't. And there's women again who take it like this and never get one. But yes, we are very relaxed about that now, whereas maybe we weren't about 4 or 5 years ago when that first became popular.
Is there a possibility, though, that getting your fertility back will take a few months to get back on track?
It really shouldn't. So that's a great question. With some of the other things, with one of the other things I'll talk about, it can delay your return to fertility. The pill should not. I always liken it to looking at like a deep lake. So the pill kind of makes the surface of the lake smooth, but it doesn't really change anything that happens below the surface. So when you remove it, anything that's happening beneath the surface starts to come back. What we do see in women who have irregular periods, that if they've been on the pill for a while and then they go off, their period's regular and then a little less regular and then a little less regular. So there does seem to be almost like a honeymoon period after going off the pill where actually fertility is improved in women who started off with irregular periods. But there's no delay, no worry that you have to flush it out of your system or just worry that you didn't get pregnant because you were on the pill.
Like if you were on like a low estrogen and you weren't getting a period, it doesn't make a difference.
Doesn't make a difference, yeah. In fact, the low estrogen is the lowest hormone amount you can do. And it's amazing that the lowest thing has the highest rate of not seeing a period when the higher things have a higher rate of seeing a period. And a lot of it, again, has to do with the packaging and the marketing. So,
is that a way of thinking that it would delay fertility? Is that like an old mindset?
Yeah,
it was actually true at one point in time.
And yes,
not true anymore.
Exactly. Yes. So, in the olden days, we had high dose, medium dose, and low dose birth control pills, and there are not any high-dose pills left on the market because they're all awful compared to what we have. There's one medium-dose pill on the market that is only used for people in extreme bleeding situations. And every single pill on the market now is low-dose, and then there's a new category of very low-dose. So, yes, in the olden days, the pills had 3 and 4 times the amount of estrogen that's in these. And there did seem to be a delay to return to fertility, but again, nobody ever studied that. So there's no data on that. It was more observations.
What about the risk of miscarriage? Is there any risk of miscarriage?
There really isn't. So, for instance, if a woman were to be on the pill and get pregnant and not realize she was pregnant and keep taking her pill, we do not see that. And part of it, keep in mind, a lot of our studies come from people who do in vitro fertilization, and they take a significant amount of hormone to make sure that there is enough there for the baby to grow and develop. And this is essentially a drop in the bucket compared to what our bodies make in that first trimester. So even if a woman took a few months to realize she was pregnant, we do not see that either increasing the miscarriage rate or causing birth defects or harm later. But it's a big surprise when you find out you actually are pregnant.
Right.
So if somebody starts using a pill that they've never taken before, how long does it take to be fully like integrated into their system so that they know they can solely use that as their contraception?
Yes.
And they don't have to use another form with it?
That's a great question. So if you are going from one pill to another, so let's say you were on this and you finish it out and started up this, there is no concern about getting pregnant going from one pill to the other. If you are starting from scratch, you were on nothing, and then you're starting up your pill with this new model, and you start on the first day of your period, they are not seeing any pregnancies in the first month. In the old model, where you started on Sunday, they were seeing pregnancies in the first month, and so the recommendation was to use backup for this first month or not rely on this for the first month. I tend to tell my patients, even though hypothetically you're covered, if you're new to this, we're not always so good at remembering and getting into the habit of it. So I'll often tell my patients, you know, you may just want to use some backup for this first month, but hypothetically you do not need to do that.
Is there a risk of spotting?
There is. And the lower the dose with the pills, the higher the risk of spotting is in the first 1 to 3 months. I would say in our world, with all the people we start on it, maybe about 1 in 5 women calls us with some spotting in the first month, maybe 1 in 10 in the second month, and then it's pretty rare after that, barring unusual circumstances. And some women are just more prone to spotting than others. Some women have, our anatomy can be a little different. Some people are better at taking it than others, but even with perfect use, you can have some spotting. So yes, that is definitely a risk. So I make sure my patients, when they're thinking about starting it, they think about that because they want to be ready for that just in case it happens.
Let's move on to the next.
Okay. The next one are these very exciting things. So I wanted to talk really quickly about the intrauterine devices. These are what these are. They do not come in purple and green. They are white or copper colored. And basically, these are little T-shaped devices that can be inserted into the uterus, and they can prevent pregnancy by creating an inhospitable environment to sperm in the uterus. There are two types of IUDs. One has a hormone in it, and one does not. The one that doesn't is called the Paragard. It is a white T-shaped guy with some copper coiled around it, and it's that copper that's irritating to the uterus and creates this sterile kind of inflammatory response that doesn't allow the sperm. It doesn't physically block the sperm, but it doesn't allow the sperm and the egg to meet. It is can be inserted anytime in a cycle. It is very, very safe and effective. The Paragard or the non-hormonal IUD, the copper IUD, has a failure rate of about 0.8%. So it's excellent. And IUDs are the most common birth control used worldwide. Our country is actually one of the slowest countries to start using IUDs compared to other places. There are three, and I'm not going to get into the nuances of them, IUDs that have hormone in them. Mirena is by far the one that most people have heard of. There's one called Skyla, one called Lyletta. The hormonal IUDs are inserted into the uterus in the same fashion. It sits there and does create this sterile kind of inflammatory response so that the sperm and the egg don't meet. It also secretes a little bit of progesterone into the uterine cavity, and that prevents your uterus from growing a lining. So a lot of women with these hormonal IUDs do not get periods. But the difference between this and the pills is those women may still be ovulating. So if you get a lot of PMS, you're still going to get it with this. You just won't necessarily be able to correlate it with a period. So this can prevent you from seeing a period, but it's necessary. You know, if you do have ovulation pain, if you're at risk for forming cysts, all those things would still exist, even though you don't see the period. Not everybody is lucky enough not to see a period. I have some people who are still moaning because they thought, oh, okay, I'm going to put it in, not have periods, and they have them every month. But even the women who do get periods on it, they tend to get very light periods. And this is even a little bit better than the non-hormonal IUD. It has a failure rate of 0.2%, so it's extremely low. A couple of things to know. Anybody really can use these, even people with a history of a clotting disorder, people with migraines, with auras. These are extremely safe and very local treatments, essentially, so they can be used. This one, the hormonal IUD, is also indicated for things like people who get heavy periods or painful periods. The non-hormonal IUD is only used for birth control, so there's no other indication for it. Pros and the cons. They are currently, with the way insurance is panning out, almost always free on people's insurance. So the cost, which was a big obstruction in the past, is often not a problem. So in our office, 93% of the insurances we take will charge a woman nothing to have an IUD inserted. So that's a good thing to know. If you don't have insurance for it, these can run you between $600 and $900. And that's not guaranteeing that you're going to like it and want to keep it in. A couple of other things. Right after the IUD, putting an IUD in can be a little bit uncomfortable. It can range from, oh, you're done, I didn't feel it, to I think I just had another baby type of cramping and contraction. It sits in the uterus like this, so it doesn't poke into anything. It doesn't insert into where the tubes go. It just sits in the uterus and creates this little irritation. That's all it does. So it doesn't block anything. It doesn't have to be inserted where the tubes go in. Not everybody has a perfectly shaped uterine cavity. So sometimes if we have a woman, most women have a cavity that is shaped kind of like an upside down pear. If you have a heart, you can imagine that IUD is not going to sit in there pretty well, and that can cause a lot of bleeding and cramping and pain. So usually it's important for us to make sure we've done an exam and often look back at any ultrasounds a woman may have had to make sure the uterine cavity is round. Common side effects, the breakthrough bleeding, cramping, heavy periods on the IUD without the hormone. On the IUD with the hormone, some women don't like not having a period, so that's actually considered a side effect. Some women do get a little systemic effect of the progesterone bloating. I had one patient get acne from it. Otherwise, most people tend to do pretty well. The one thing I'll say about the hormonal IUD is you may only get two periods a year, but you have no idea when they're coming. So a lot of women are a little, you know, we get a few calls saying, I think I'm having a period, and we'll say, yes, you probably are, but invariably it's coming before a wedding or before a trip or something like that. So that has to be kept in mind. About 1 in 100 IUDs can be expelled. I was trying to come up with the word expulsed. So the uterus is not meant to have something in there unless it's a baby growing. And so sometimes the uterus doesn't like it and it will start to cramp and you'll feel like you're in labor and it'll literally push the IUD out. That's very rare, and probably, as much as we don't like to take ownership of it, may have to do with it potentially not being placed in the right spot to begin with. And then extremely rarely in women, particularly who've had multiple uterine surgeries like C-sections, there is the small chance that it can end up somewhere it doesn't belong, like in the abdomen. So sometimes when women have had multiple C-sections, the uterus can be thin, and the IUD can poke through there. So that obviously is the worst case scenario, and we have to go get it and, of course, not use that again. It is... again, probably the most common birth control pill used worldwide. It is the best birth control a woman can do of all the things that are available to us. It is extremely well studied. Even the progesterone IUD has been around for over 50 years. So we do feel very comfortable placing it. And a lot of us, particularly in our office, we're a little wimpy, so if we think someone has had many C-sections or had surgeries, we can place them under ultrasound guidance to make sure that they go to the right spot. So luckily, our rates of, you know, losing them are thankfully extremely low. Anybody have questions about the IUDs?
I just have one question. What's the difference in terms of people who want to be constantly, like, more on a schedule of, like, getting pregnant every year, every 2 years, or whatever, versus, because I know that there's, like, a thing of, if you're not planning on getting pregnant for, like, 5 years, then...
Yeah.
This probably would be your best choice versus, okay, I'm thinking maybe I just had a baby, but I don't have a, you know, in 2 years from now.
Yeah, that's actually...
And taking
perfect question, because when the IUD goes in, it can cause spotting after it goes in for up to even 2 to 3 months, in some ways somewhat similar to this, but more common. And if you were going to wait, for instance, if you were going to get pregnant in a year, going through the insertion, spotting for 3 months, only to remove it, may be a whole lot to go through when you could just do something, potentially something else. Our most common people for the IUDs traditionally have been our women who are either completely done or 98% done. And that is starting to change. We are starting to see more women do them between babies. And then the key that you will explain, because you could do a much better job than I could, is waiting till you've been to the mikvah at least once after you have a baby before you put this in. Otherwise, the spotting can be really prohibitive. And then the other thing that your point brings up is if you do choose the IUD with hormone in it, it is the one thing that can delay your return to fertility. So it doesn't change your fertility, but it could take 3 or 4 months for your cycles to come back. So if you're only going to use it for a year or two between babies, and then you're going to pull it out maybe 3 or 4 months early, it just may not end up being, you know, worth it.
You're not hormonal, you're not, you're still ovulating.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So those are good questions. Did you have a question? Oh, sorry. I'm going to talk just for 2 seconds about the diaphragm. I don't know if anyone's seen these before. It should not come with a big hole in the middle. Otherwise, we're in big trouble. So this is what a diaphragm is. It is a barrier method, so it is not our most preferred method for birth control. It is really good for women who have strong contraindications to hormones, or women who do kind of have a funny uterine shape and spot from some of these other things. It requires using spermicide. You put spermicide in here, you fold it, you put it in the vagina, and it has to not just go in there, but it has to be situated perfectly. So it can take a little bit of practice. And then after it's in, you have to put more spermicide in, and then it needs to stay in for 6 hours after intercourse. Otherwise, and it, you know, continues to kind of create that barrier and prevent the sperm from getting into the cervix. With all of that, it has a 12% failure rate. So it's not a great form of birth control. And then the spermicide itself can be very irritating. We see a lot of women get vaginal infections and things like that from spermicide. Who could use it? Anybody could potentially use it. I can't tell you how many times I prescribed it and had a woman call me up a month later and say, okay, just give me the pills. It does require planning. It does require having the spermicide. It used to be one of the few options we had, and with some of the improvement in our other things, it's fallen a little bit to the wayside. In fact, this company, Ortho, does not even make it anymore. So for a while, there was nobody even making it in the United States, and now there is one company that's making it. So we can provide it to people if they want. But it does require a woman being able to put it in the vagina, place it specifically, check it to make sure it's there, and do all those steps. It just needs to be cleaned with warm water, and you always need to check for things like holes, because if there's a hole, it won't be working. And there are different sizes, and we pick a size depending on a woman's anatomy. Some women need a bigger one, particularly if they've had babies before and their cervix is a little bit bigger, and other women need a little teeny tiny one. And then the last thing I'm going to talk about, one of the other reasons why this isn't our most preferred thing, has everybody heard of toxic shock syndrome? That has been associated with tampon use, and particularly in tampons that have been left in for long periods of time. So this needs to stay in for a minimum of 6 hours post-intercourse, and there have been cases of toxic shock syndrome with diaphragms. So we tend to, again, keep this in our armamentarium, but not necessarily our first choice unless we don't have other options. And lastly, I'm going to talk about spermicide. And spermicide can come, I had to write it down, cream, film, gel, foam. The failure rate of spermicide is 28%. So that means 1 in every 4 times a woman sexually active using spermicide, she's at risk for getting pregnant. We have lots of spermicide babies in our practice, probably more than anything else. There is a chemical called non-oxynil 9 that is the chemical in all of these forms of spermicide. And there really isn't actually better rates with one versus the other in terms of the cream or the gel or the film. It basically kills the sperm upon contact. It can, in some women, create some vaginal sensitivity and infections. It can be pretty messy. And occasionally we'll have women, just like you can have an allergic reaction to anything, have an allergic reaction to it or develop a sensitivity to it over time. So it can be really good for short intervals of time, potentially, or bridging, like maybe we're starting up on the pill and we're just going to use some backup spermicide for this month. But as a long-term method for birth control, it really is not great. And that's all I've got.
I was thinking, before I say my piece, since Dr. Allen did this tonight only, should we have her do menopause now so everyone can hear the medical piece of menopause, and then I will go after
for
that.
For those of us.
Because everyone put in an effort to come tonight, and I can be around next week.
Okay, so, you sure? Okay.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that we get all of Dr. Allen
okay.
tonight. Because we, is that okay? I mean, I think that's a good
okay, point. Perfect. Switching gears. All right. So, if anybody else is confused about the terms menopause, perimenopause, postmenopause, these are all very vague terms that do have definitions but get used inappropriately all the time. So the definition of menopause is having had 12 months in a row without a period on our own, meaning not having a period because we're using something to make us not have a period. When women are in menopause, essentially our brain doesn't know that and still tells the ovary, come on, get an egg out there. It's the ovary that essentially stops working the way it works to make eggs. So that is how we are no longer fertile. We no longer ovulate eggs anymore. And when there is no ovulation, there is therefore no stimulation to the uterus to build up lining, and therefore there's no period. There are things that can alter menopause timing. The average age is 51 and a half. In our country, in healthy non-smoking women, if you smoke, you can have an earlier menopause. You can genetically have an earlier menopause if it runs in the family. You could take certain medications that can put you into menopause. A lot of chemotherapy drugs can put you into menopause. In terms of smoking, there is a direct correlation with how much you smoke and how much earlier you have your menopause. The perimenopause is also known as the menopause transition. It's the time from when you start getting those hot flashes or feeling hot at night or having some vaginal dryness or feeling extra cranky to when you hit the 12-month mark of no periods. And then once you've hit that 12-month period, all the time after that is considered postmenopause. So it's a relatively garbage can of words that all kind of sort of mean somewhat the same thing. I think perimenopause is relevant because that's from symptoms to stopping. Postmenopause is relevant because that's our life after we've reached that 12-month mark. Did you have a question?
So if you, let's say, have an IUD, how would you know?
You might not know. So that's a really good question. If you have an IUD with hormone in it, you may not have a period, and a little bit of that progesterone may knock out some of the symptoms, so you may not know. And if you've got an IUD in there secreting progesterone, you can't do a blood test to see where you're at because it may not be relevant because you've got hormone in your body.
So it probably doesn't really make a difference.
Exactly. The only thing you have to think about is, okay, if I could be in menopause, maybe there are certain medicines I wouldn't take or things I would do differently, etc. But yes, and we don't necessarily take someone's IUD out to find out. If we have a woman doing well with an IUD, we just leave it until it's expired, basically. A couple of other things, surgical menopause. Some women will need, for some reason, to have their ovaries removed. Maybe they carry a breast cancer gene and do that, or maybe they have something like a cyst or a mass on their ovaries and then they're taken out. Surgical menopause is awful because you go from having lots of hormone to none, so we tend to treat with some hormone to prevent symptoms there. And then some women do have premature menopause, which means they go through menopause before they're 40. That's pretty rare, but it can happen. And while we have very few studies on why that happens to some women, it seems to be more common in women that have other endocrine disorders, like really bad thyroid issues or other types of issues related to that. And once a woman is in premature menopause, It is sometimes possible to reverse that and sometimes not. So that would be not a topic for today, but something that would require some extra help. Symptoms, everybody hears about them, the hot flashes or hot flushes, the night sweats, which are basically just hot flashes when you're sleeping. Essentially, our temperature regulation can go haywire, and it doesn't take much to get really hot, and it doesn't take much to then be freezing because you're covered in sweat. So there is not any rules about it. Every single woman's menopause is different. 80% of women get hot flashes, and about 9% will still have them when they're 70 and on. So hopefully that will be nobody in this room. The menstrual periods. If you're not using anything hormonal, the hallmark is to have periods be very erratic. They can come when they want. They can last how long they want. One can be light, one can be heavy. They can be very different cycle to cycle to cycle. So it can be a little bit challenging to know what is normal, what isn't sometimes. So we have lots of phone calls about that to try to sort that out. The sleep disturbances are quite common and usually related to having a hot flash at night, which then wakes you up. Most women either wake up boiling hot or wake up because they were hot and now they're sweaty and cold. The vaginal dryness can be a hallmark of menopause, and that can be really difficult for things like general irritation. Pain during intercourse can be a big issue for women, so those are things that we talk about. Some people notice weight changes, a lot of people do. When we transition from not in menopause to being a postmenopausal woman, we do tend to lose our hair and become our apple. So everybody talks about the spare tire. We do tend to have different patterns of fat deposition afterward, unfortunately. And that can be genetic too. Some of us get better genes than others about that. The other thing that I think is important to know is that anxiety and depression can be very much more prone to anxiety and depression during perimenopause and menopause. There are a lot of receptors and proteins in the brain that become very accentuated during menopause. So if it took this much to make you anxious at 45, it may take this much to make you anxious at 50. And again, some women are more predisposed to that than others. If a woman comes in and she's having some symptoms, we do always rule out a thyroid disorder. We make sure a woman's not pregnant if she's missing periods, because we do sometimes see pregnancies then. We make sure there isn't anything else going on. There is one blood test. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So you mentioned that periods could be erratic. Does that mean that it's possible to get pregnant if the person's still fertile?
Yes. So as we travel through our 40s, it is less and less likely month to month that we would have a cycle and ovulate an egg that had the potential to get fertilized. But it can happen. So we do recommend that women are conscious about birth control up until menopause. Now, we definitely individualize things based on a woman's history, when her last baby was, what she may be doing for birth control, what her life situation is, but it is possible to get pregnant up until you have gone the 12 months without a period. In my first week of practice, I had a 54-year-old who was pregnant walk in. And it's very rare, but it can happen. So it is important to kind of look at what your cycles are doing and make sure that you're careful.
Did she carry in term?
No, she didn't. I know. And so that does happen. As we get older, we're more prone to miscarrying, to ovulating eggs that aren't normal. And some of those eggs can get fertilized and start to grow. So we just have to keep these types of things in mind.
So if you're on the, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
So if you're on the pill and you're not sure you're going through menopause, the only way to tell is to do a blood test?
Yes. So if you're on a pill like this, you can do a blood test on your placebo week. If you're on a pill like this, you need to create a placebo week. And there is a blood test you can do, an FSH test, which is a hormone from the brain. So again, the brain doesn't know the ovary is not working. So when the ovary doesn't do the right thing, the brain starts to produce more and more and more FSH to try to get the ovary to comply. So if that level's really high, that's positive for menopause. However, if you were destined to have 4 periods in a year, you would have 4 months with a normal FSH and 8 months with a high FSH. So one blood test does not tell you for sure where you are.
So you just do on the placebo pill.
Exactly. At the end of the placebo week. Yeah. And again, one blood test doesn't necessarily tell you. So even if your FSH is really high, you could still have a period the next month. So we have, again, women's health care, not studied. We have no predictive tests to tell a woman when she will be done or how far away she is from being done.
Is it genetic? Like if your mother went through
menopause? A bit. So the more extreme cases tend to be genetic, people that go very late, like close to 60, or people that go very early. A lot of the little nuances around 50, 51 can be affected by things like we tend to eat a little healthier, exercise a little more, be a little bit more active, and that can sometimes change things from what our moms were doing.
So in practice, if you have a 46-year-old woman who's like on year two or three of her IUD,
yeah.
Would you then replace it in 2 years?
I would give her the choice. So I would say, hey, in 2 years, if you go by the statistics, you're likely to still be getting periods. We can either just take out your IUD and put another one in, or we could potentially take it out, see what happens, and then put another one in if we don't like what happens. There is a 3-year IUD now. So the Mirena, I didn't go into details, it's good for 5 years. There is a 3-year version of that now. So a woman who's borderline there may consider that to then take that out in 3 years. But in general, we don't think the progesterone is unsafe past menopause, so we aren't afraid to leave those IUDs in for longer. Other things we don't like about menopause, our bone density goes down. So we're more at risk for hip fractures, osteoporosis, our cholesterol goes up, our skin is a little bit less firm, and our hair tends to fall out a little bit. Our weight tends to go up, so all those lovely things can happen. And a lot of those are really genetic. And then really quickly, treatments. So there's two, just like the birth control pills, we've got the hormonal and the non-hormonal. Everybody's looking for the perfect non-hormone to treat menopause symptoms so that they can avoid using a hormone. And there just isn't the perfect thing out there for everybody. There is actually the number one category for non-hormonal treatment for menopause symptoms are the antidepressants. They do have some cross activity in treating menopause symptoms. The most commonly used antidepressants in younger women, the Zoloft, the Prozac, are the worst ones for women who are going through the menopause transition. So they need Celexa, Lexapro, Effexor, and somebody's OBGYN should be able to help guide them with which one would be better than the other. There are some herbs out there. St. John's wort has been marketed for mood symptoms. Black cohosh, which always sounds like something illegal, but it's not, is great for, in some women, for hot flashes. But a lot of these herbs, and then the phytoestrogens, like soy-based estrogens, have been very popular. But all of these things can actually cause breast tenderness and breast stimulation. So you have to be careful if you use them and make sure that you're watching for things like that. And then there's a drug called Neurontin, which was originally an anti-seizure drug and then got used for pain management, which also seems to help for hot flashes, but tends to only be used in women in relatively extreme situations where they can't use estrogen. And then there's the estrogen and the progesterone. So nothing replaces a lack of estrogen like estrogen. So if your symptoms are all from not having estrogen, then it would make sense to give the estrogen back. Well, of course, that sounds easy, and it actually is pretty easy to write that prescription, but there's a lot of baggage with estrogen, as people know, largely the breast cancer risk. So everybody hears about that, and it is true that if you take hormone replacement with estrogen in it, your risk for breast cancer goes up. You will see 3 more cases per 1,000 women of breast cancer if you use hormone replacement. You'll see 2.5 more cases of stroke, 3 more cases per 1,000 women of pulmonary embolus, increased risk of gallbladder disease. You will lower your risk for things like hip fractures, colorectal cancer, diabetes, it will help the vaginal canal. People feel good on hormones, but the baggage is pretty significant. So really, when I have somebody in my office, it's a, let's get out the scale of risks and benefits and put things on either side and see where we end up.
Why is there baggage for hormones in menopause but not for birth
control? Really good question. Because our bodies are different. So how we metabolize things are different. in when we're premenopausal and young, we have this hierarchy of hormonal production, and then the estrogen that we produce circulates through our body and helps all these different organs, our bones, our hair, our skin. When we don't have that anymore, we then start to metabolize differently. We use different hormones in our body. We become more testosterone heavy because we have, while we have the same amount of testosterone we had before, we've lost our estrogen. So we function differently. And then what's natural? Well, what's natural is for us not to have hormone in our body. That's what's natural when we go through menopause. But, you know, some women will have one hot flash a week and some of them will have one every 5 minutes. So it really has to be a risk-benefit ratio. And most women who do hormones can get off them relatively quickly, like within 2 to 5 years. That's hormones. Yes.
I thought that whole study that came out, like, whatever, 10 years ago.
Women's Health Initiative study, yeah.
It came out later that it was a little bit hyped up and exaggerated, that the risk wasn't as great, and that, because then all the women back then went off of it, and all the symptoms came back, and now they're, I thought they were kind of going back to hormones, they started being safe-ish.
It's, exactly, and it's that whole pendulum thing. It was, the pendulum was in the middle, the study came out, and it went here, like everybody got off, and everybody did, and then slowly it's coming back toward the middle, because some people are fine off, and some people are not. So what we've really done is when the dust has settled, we've realized, okay, are you willing to accept a 0.03% increased risk of breast cancer to use this for 5 years, yes or no? And some women say, no, you know, I'm doing okay. And other women say, I'm miserable, and my quality of life is poor, and I need it to get to sleep, and I need it to function during the day. So we've let women decide, of course, taking into account family history, et cetera, to help figure out what's the best to do. And a lot of my women are really willing to try some other things first, which is nice, but if they don't work, sometimes we're back to the estrogen.
Is the level of estrogen in the pill the same as estrogen replacement hormone?
This is a multitude of times heavier than what you're getting in hormone replacement. So if I have a woman who's taking this up to menopause and decided, yep, I know I'm probably in menopause, but I want to keep taking hormone, we do transition her over to hormone replacement. And they make hormone replacement either using the same estrogen and progesterone in different doses, or they make it using a different formulation of hormones. Everybody's heard probably of Prempro and Premarin and Provera were the kind of old-fashioned gold standard. Those were different formulations of the same hormones. But there is actually hormone replacement that are the same as these.
So if you don't know whether you're in perimenopause or menopause, and you're still taking, is that a risk?
So it can be, yes, because, again, no hormone is natural past menopause. So while we don't know for sure, it's probably safe to assume that any hormone past menopause may increase your risk for breast cancer, say. We don't have the studies to prove it, because once you've done one study that shows a risk, it's not ethical to do more with different types of the same thing. But we just have to make that assumption. So what we'll do in the office, for instance, is start checking these FSHs more commonly when we're hitting 51 and 52 and 53. And once we've gotten a few FSHs that are all high, we'll say, okay, finish out your pack, and then let's start you on hormone replacement.
So how would you prevent pregnancy in that perimenopausal time?
We would assume that we were in menopause if we've had multiple FSHs that were high over time. So like if I had a woman check an FSH, let's say in January, and then maybe she checked it in March, and maybe she checked it in June, and they were all high, I'd say to her, yes, I can't promise you the chance is zero, but we've got to be zero to almost zero. And then we'll transition a woman over at that time. So we don't make a woman, for instance, go off to prove that they're there. Because most of our women may want to go off just to see what type of symptoms they have. But if I have a woman who doesn't want to go off, we'll just transition them over. So it's very inexact. You're hitting, you know, the nail on the head there with the fact that a lot of what we do, you know, we don't necessarily formally meet the definition, but we just use judgment. Yes, unfortunately, that's very true. So if you use hormone for, say, pain with intercourse and vaginal dryness, as long as you use it, those symptoms are better. But if you stop using it, you get the same lack of estrogen. So it is unfortunately the case that you need to keep, if you needed it, you need to keep using it.
But then it comes back even worse, the symptoms.
It shouldn't come back even worse, but I think what really happens is these symptoms do evolve over time. So if I, for instance, had a woman who was new to menopause and started her on something, and then 2 years later took her off of it, it may feel worse to her, but I think that's more because she's here in space and not because there's a withdrawal effect. So there shouldn't really not be a withdrawal effect.
If a woman's menopause and occurs in vaginal dryness, can they use a topical estrogen?
Yes. So thank you for saying that. There are locally applied estrogens that can be done in a gel, a cream, a pill, and even a little rubber ring that women can put in the vagina and just let a little bit of estrogen come out and just treat the vaginal area. Those can be very effective. Again, they do need to be continuously used. So that would be, like, if a woman said, the only thing that's really bothering me is vaginal dryness, everything else I can live with, that would be a perfect use for that. Sometimes women who leak urine can get some benefit from that, too. Hopefully that'd be nobody.
That's perfect. Okay, wow. I'm certainly glad I came tonight. Like I said, I came to hear Dr. Ellman. That was a wealth of information. Due to the time, I am going to limit what I'm going to say. I'm going to use up 10 more minutes. We'll go to 9:30, and then whatever I don't get in tonight will be continued in our next week's session when we meet with the college teachers answering the hotline phone call, which will be at 8 o'clock at the Wi-Fi Center. Most of what I'm going... I am going to shorten it on the spot, so work with me on that. But I would not have changed any of that for one piece of information that you shared with us tonight. I think that was incredibly helpful, informative, maybe save some time in the office for some of the patients. But we just, this is things that we are all worrying about, all thinking about. We all think we're doing it alone. We all think we're the only ones who are going through these things in life. And it's fabulous to have a physician who is so open and helpful. With helping us go through our stages. Where does all that leave us halachically? Really confused. There's a lot out there, but I'm going to focus on the positive. So there's a lot going through all of that physically in life leaves a lot for us to take care of halachically. I will first say that before we go ahead with that, that all halachic decisions will always and should always be made in consultation with your doctor. Like I said before, they go hand in hand. There is no halachic decision about a woman's body or her physical well-being that would not take into account her medical reality. That information will always be gotten from the doctor. A rabbi giving a psak for a couple or going through something medical will always ask and include the doctor's recommendation and the doctor's advice before he would give the halachic recommendation. That is essential to any halachic decision. So as medical decisions come up, halacha will always be there with an answer, and it is our job in our own lives to figure out how those two worlds combine. Again, having a doctor like Dr. Ellman, who is so sensitive to it, or other doctors out there, are there to help us figure that out. And of course, the rabbis in our community, the rebbitzins in our communities, the women on the hotline are also there to help us find the halachic answer to all of these life situations. Just quickly, I want to go through two things about birth control. When we talk about birth control, there are two things to take into account halachically. One is which type of birth control is preferred halachically and why. And the second one is once we've established which one of these options we're going to use, where does that leave us with the staining and the insertion of the IUD and all of those things that we know from learning it as a bride or along the way could cause some halachic questions. So starting with number one, which one is the most preferred? There is a concept, before we get to that, there is a concept in halacha called hashkatat zera, which is referring to the destruction or the wasting of semen during intercourse. Halacha states that it is ideal that there should not be any hashkatat zera at all through intercourse. So therefore, any form of birth control that interrupts the normal way of intercourse or causes a barrier to the semen is generally not accepted by halacha. So, and the flip of that is true too. that any form that does not interrupt the normal way of intercourse or does not cause a barrier, that will be the preferred method. So after this amazing presentation, we see that halachically not all birth controls are created equally within halacha, but we can take what we learned from Dr. Ellman and see which ones will be more accepted. So the most widely accepted that doesn't interrupt with any type of natural way of intercourse and doesn't cause any hashkata tazara is the pill. The pill or the NuvaRing. Those are hormonal. Those a woman takes orally. They don't get in the way of anything that happens naturally during intercourse. So those are really the preferred methods. The IUD would be the next. And for most rabbis in our community, they are lenient with the IUD for the same reason, meaning it is acceptable for the same reason. Although it is sitting in the uterus and one could come up with a conversation about why it might, the after studies and halachically the bottom line is it is an acceptable way of birth control because it does not interrupt with the things that we are concerned with. Spermicides, as you said, are lacking a lot of effectiveness, but if we are using them at times, we should know that most people are also okay with it because it does not interfere, and it doesn't always work, but it doesn't interfere either. But it's available when needed for that short term. The diaphragm that you mentioned, and as you mentioned, it is a barrier method. Because of that, it has more halachic complications to it. If it came up that your physician told you the diaphragm was what you were left with as an option, it would be appropriate to be in touch with a rav just to figure out halachically how that could be handled. It's important to note here that forms of birth control that are not usually accepted, which are a condom and the morning after pill, for various halachic reasons, those are not really accepted methods of birth control. It's important to note in extenuating circumstances, such as if, God forbid, one of the couple is going through chemo and the other member would be exposed to chemo, that's one extenuating circumstance. Again, it is not recommended that condoms should be used without consultation from a rav. And as challenging of a conversation as that is, you have rebbetzins, kala teachers, and I can promise you, you are not the first to ask it. The rav has been asked this before. The rav has dealt with it. Just as we come to Dr. Ellman, get our physical exam, do everything we need to do, and we think, how are we doing this in front of a physician? A rav is the same way. They've heard it before. They've seen it before. They're there to help you and get you the information. So in very extenuating circumstances, it's there to be discussed, again, keeping all members of the couple safe. So that's really the piece about understanding the spectrum of what is this conversation halakhically about birth control. So that's the conversation. We have the pills and the hormones, which really seem to not interrupt any natural course of intercourse. Those are the preferred ways. The IUD works well for that. Moving beyond that, once it gets into more complicated situation, it will be a less preferred method. Okay, so that's number one. Number one is which birth control can use. I mean, step one is getting the okay. Step two is which birth control are we going to use, understanding the spectrum of which ones are preferred and which ones are not preferred. The next step in it would be, okay, now we're on these pills, and I just learned a lot about what will happen with our bodies, with the staining, with the everything as we are on these pills. Okay. The main issues that are going to come into effect halachically from any form of birth control, I don't think this is new to anybody who is in this room and married, is one, opening of the cervix. Halachically, opening of the cervix about 1/4 of an inch could cause a woman to be nida. Number two would be staining. Different types of staining will cause a woman to be nida. But I will repeat, not all staining will cause a woman to be nida. That is very different than what we heard in our kala classes. As a kala, we hear a period, and anything tinted makes us a nida, and we get all nervous. Now that we're older, a little more experienced, we are understanding now, not all staining will make a woman a nida. That's, we're going to run through that again. And of course, the third one, which we are definitely not going to get to tonight, are the effects that changing our period and our schedule will have on our veset, which is our calendar days. And that's a much more detailed one. I'm definitely going to address that next week, as we don't have enough time. Just tonight, the two things I'd really like to discuss, like I said, the main one is the opening of the cervix and staining. As far as opening of the cervix from these different birth control, obviously the only one that does that could possibly be the IUD, and just it is out there. It does not, the instrument that you use to open it and to insert it does not open the cervix enough, so that does not cause nida. The actual opening of the cervix will not cause nida. the staining that happens afterwards that we're going to talk about next. Okay, so I'm just going to give a brief conversation about staining. And the staining, I feel like I give it every time I speak because it's always the most relevant piece to most women. It is effective. It is the same. Staining is always the same situation, whether it's because of menopause, whether it's because of insertion of the IUD, whether it's because of a pill you're taking, whether it's because of a new pill you're taking, whether it's because you're nursing, whether it's because you're on the progesterone, all staining was created equal. So that's helpful for us because once we learn it once, we got it for the rest of our lives. Okay, what is staining? Briefly, it is so important, and again, when we learned this as a bride, I think we heard it differently. So it's great to hear it newly as a married woman. When we the Torah tells us that a husband and wife cannot be together when a woman has her period. A woman is in Nida De'oraita from the Torah when she has her monthly flow. That means it's her period, it came monthly when she was expecting it, and it was a full flow. That is what makes a woman Nida for sure. And even that has complications about what kind, but that's way beyond our conversation tonight. But let's go with her monthly flow in the time that she's expecting it and a heavy flow. That is what makes her Nida De'oraita. Now, we love more halachot. I don't know if you know that. Like, you know, we're only not supposed to cook a goat in its mother's milk, yet we have lots of dishes. Why is that? Because when we are excited about something and enthusiastic about a halacha, we add more to it. So just like to avoid having a goat cooked in its mother's milk, as the Torah tells us, and now we have lots of dishes and showers are fun, so too, there are a lot of halachot derabanan that we keep as well to make sure that the Torah one is very well protected. And that is why halacha and came up with this idea that staining could also be nida. Now, once halacha is creating that protective fence, which is a phrase that we use a lot, we are creating the system by which to say, you know what, her monthly flow is do-raita. We really need to make sure that stains, you know, anything that's staining could possibly look like that. But once it is being set up, once halacha has created the fence for us, halacha said not all staining is going to make her a nida. Only the following type, which is why when you've heard those criteria, and this I hope sounds familiar, and if it doesn't, that's why we're here tonight, the color of the stain, the size of the stain, and what the stain is seen on will all decide if that stain caused nida. I'm pausing because it's a lot to think about. The size of the stain, the color of the stain, and what it was seen on. And I like to quote Rav Schwartz, may have a refuah shalema, who once said in our meeting, he said, we're not arguing with mitzias, which means the reality of it being dam. We're just saying it might not be dam nida. It might not be dam that causes her. It might not be blood that causes her to be a nida. That's huge. So that's why you always hear the college teachers talking about the color, the size, and what it falls on. And when you call to ask, they'll say, well, what did you see it on? And what color and what size was it? Because it's so important. So just a quick review is, what size is it? If a woman sees a stain smaller than a grist, the size of like a U.S. penny, she can absolutely ignore the stain. It could be flaming red with a flag that says, I came from the uterus. It doesn't matter. If it's smaller than a grist, she can absolutely ignore it. And she can carry on and pretend she didn't see it. Actually, it's kind of funny. Like, wouldn't that be helpful? I mean, you could tell. But she can ignore it wholeheartedly and feel great about it. She knows it's not anything she has to care for. That's number one, the size of the stain. That's the easy one, the helpful. The next thing is what she sees it on. Okay, if she sees it on color, halacha tells us you don't know the real color. I'm a nursery school teacher. I know the Crayola box really well, okay? If it comes out on color, I think I know red, right? I've seen a lot of red. There's a great book called The Day the Crayons Took Off and the red gets all upset it was used. Okay, it's a great book. You know, I think I know red. Halacha says to me, you don't know red. If you saw it on blue, if you saw it on black, if you saw it on a garment that was colored, you don't know the real color. That's why you always hear people say, wear colored underwear, wear colored underwear, wear colored underwear. That's why the mikvah sells black panty liners. That is why if a woman sees or knows that there's a stain but it's on color, she can ignore it. The side point is that we don't get to wear colored underwear during our period and say we didn't see it. I will admit there is a balance of responsibility and honesty and that we don't get to wear dark underwear and say, I don't have a period. I didn't see anything. So once there is that judgment, but the bottom line is for staining and I will say, and I think Dr. Elmo would agree, except for a few cases, most women will know the difference between their staining and their period. That's what all the years before marriage are for. You figure out the difference. You know when you got your period. You know what your period is. When it is staining, it is staining. So we got the color. We got the size. If it's smaller than a gris, you get to ignore it. What it falls on, if it is seen on color, you can ignore it. That is why we will be wearing dark. Certainly, if we're going through menopause, we should be wearing dark. If we're starting a new pill and we're not sure, we should be wearing dark. When we say dark, I'll just be very clear. It doesn't matter what color the whole underwear is. We're talking about the crotch area, the area of interest where the stain will be seen. We could wear black panty liners there if we don't have that. Many post-scheme, and this is a little bit harder, but many post-scheme will even say a white panty liner will not absorb the tuma of the stain. Very lofty halachic idea. I'm not going into that, but the point is a stain seen on even a white panty liner will most likely not cause a woman to be nida. It might make the woman crazy because she saw color and she gets nervous. That's why we like to recommend dark so that we can be at more ease and worry about one less thing. But knowingly, if you don't have a black liner or it's unavailable, even wearing a white liner as opposed to white cotton underwear would protect a woman from her stain causing nida. Seeing a stain on white cotton is not great. So what we want, don't buy any white sheets. Don't buy any white towels, or if you do, let your guests use them. Don't use them yourself. You don't want white cotton near you. White cotton is the enemy until you're in menopause. So, like, that's it. Enjoy those luxurious sheets when you're older. But that's generally the rule. And, of course, the third criteria is the color. Bright red of the stain would be a problem. Anything white and yellow we know is not a problem. If you get that orange and brown, those are the challenging colors. Those are the hard ones to know. It's hard for a woman to tell within the brown, within the black, within that mucousy color, how red it is, how much of that is going to be a stain. That's the part where if a woman wasn't sure herself how to make that judgment call, consultation would be appropriate. Consultation could be done in lots of different ways. Nowadays, we are, again, so blessed that it's so easy to get something looked at anonymously, easily within that day. There are tons of rabbanim who will look at a stain. Again, I really compare them to doctors where it's academic. It is what they do. They are not attached to the bodily fluids like we are. We are way more attached to our own bodily fluids, appropriately so. I myself am a FedEx service. I can tell you, it gets taken to the Rav. The Rav never knows what it is. I think the neighbors of the Rabbanim are wondering, like, why are there so many brown bags coming in? But everyone knows, and they are there. And my reason for advocating for that is, A, to keep the rabbis busy, but, B, I come with the idea that they have learned it, but more importantly, we are doing this mitzvah. Every woman in this room who is here tonight is somehow involved in this mitzvah. We are putting in our time, we are putting in our effort, we actually put in our souls in a very, very emotional, important, meaningful part. It has to do with our relationship, it has to do with our marriage. Every woman who does it has the right to have the accurate information. And either from personal experience or working from women, when you don't have the accurate information, what ends up happening is we make a judgment on our own, which once we're taught, you should. But until that point where you feel confident with the decision, you have the right to learn it. You have the right to feel confident in the judgment you have made. You have the right to feel that you are doing this mitzvah properly. And along, what happens is along the way, every woman will learn her own colors. Every woman will learn which stains are a problem. It happens. It really does. If we taught at the Kala classes what colors were okay and which ones were not, I'm pretty sure we'd have no one getting married. So we opted out of that option, and we decided that the education should come after she's married, because really, I only need to know my own colors. I don't need to know anybody else's colors. Every woman here needs to know her own color. She doesn't need to know anything else. So if we're lucky, the discharge will either be bright red and it's really clear, or a light, lovely yellow mucousy, and that's not a problem. If it comes out in that orange or the light pink or the light brown or the dark brown, it is appropriate then to find out how to judge that. What is not appropriate is to say, ooh, I saw something tinted. I must be Anita. That's like saying, ooh, it's Tuesday, I need a break. I'm going to go do Shabbos. Like, you don't keep Shabbos on Tuesday. There's not so much value to that. So there's no value in making a stain, a nida stain, when it's not. Again, if I can be of help, if the hotline can be of help, any representative in the community is available to help with that. Okay.
Is there any way to get out of wearing white underwear under 7 clean days and then you don't see
spotting? In extenuating circumstances. Is if in a case, so this is where medicine and halacha love to work together. So if a woman is having a staining issue, like she said, whether it be from the progesterone and she's staining a lot postpartum, or she started a new pack and her body is in those first 3 months that she's adjusting, if you call a rav and say this woman has not been to the mikvah in 3 weeks, you're going to get like, you know, barely look and get her to the mikvah. Because believe it or not, and this is something I once heard from a rebbetzin, and I forgot her name and I forget it, the kedusha of this mitzvah actually isn't in all the bedikah. The kedusha of this mitzvah is when the woman has gone to the mikvah and the husband and wife get to be reunited physically. That is the kedusha. I remember she said in her talk, she said, all the books stop. You know, we're also religious and we're also excited about our doing our bedikot and counting and bathing and getting ready. We're all, sure we are. We're also excited about that. But then the book stops. Then the book stops. And it gives the impression that the story ends there. And really the story does not end there. That's actually the beginning of the next story, a very important story in our tradition. And what I found over time, that the more you ask, the more you know. That's first of all. And secondly, halacha has answers that are there to get the couple back together. There's no question. So that's available. So I'm going to summarize, and obviously did not get to everything that I wanted to, and I was hoping to go through all the different methods specifically, but I didn't. We're going to stick with that. The hotline is here to help. That's the plug for the hotline. The hotline is always here to help. But more importantly, that as you go through these stages medically with Dr. Elman or your OBGYN, and we have all these choices to make and all these medical evolving situations, I would say, remember, halacha evolves too. Halacha in your life will evolve. And, you know, just like we don't want to hear about menopause when we're getting married, that's what I remember, not so much anymore, you know, you don't listen to that part. You learn it as your life goes on. Remember, halacha is the same way. It started one place when we got married. It started one place at one stage in life when you're having kids. And it changes. And as your life evolves, as your medical reality evolves, so too does halacha. And there are people here to help us with that. I just need to say thank you profoundly to Dr. Elman for your time. Besides being so grateful that you spoke and gave us so much information, it goes without saying that this is a journey that we are all on here. There's a balance that we are always trying to hit, and to have someone as caring and patient and understanding as you, makes us so grateful. So really, thank you for sharing your knowledge, and come back next week for part 2 at the Wi-Fi at 8 o'clock. Thank you so much.